The last several weeks, we have been talking about the subject of wisdom. I'm going to attempt this morning to be building upon the principles that we have been laying out. And we're probably going to find ourselves in a bit of a series here where we're talking about different aspects of wisdom playing out in our lives. And I hope that it's been good for you. I know that it's been good for me. I don't know about you, but whenever the Lord is teaching me something, you know, many times, often, He'll be teaching me and explaining something to me at the same time He's walking me through it in my life. And so one lesson plays off the other. You know, I'll be spending time in the Word, and He'll be highlighting something. You know, He'll be sharing with me. You're talking about loving your neighbor as yourself, right? And something is coming alive there, and then I'll find myself in the middle of opportunity, right? Because the neighbor's dog went and did something in my yard, or the kids were, you know, and you find yourself in a moment where the Word revealed truth. And also, though, it illuminated your heart, and then it tested your life. So in one stroke, you're coming to know something, and in the next stroke, it's being tested in your life. Has anyone else experienced this phenomenon? Yeah, it's called walking with God. It's not a strange phenomenon. This is the experience. He is a good Father. We sang about that this morning. Where a father would teach a lesson to a child and then give them opportunity to express the truth of the lesson they just taught them. Aren't you glad? I'm giving you fair warning this morning because we're going to talk about some stuff. And what's going to happen, maybe not immediately following, but you will, in this week, have opportunity to live out exactly what we're talking about. And so if you want to escape this reality, you should run now. Wisdom is a funny thing. It is the explanation, or it is the revealing of truth, but not just so that your brain gets educated. It is the revealing of truth in your actual real-time life. It's the process of the Lord walking next to you and training your steps in how to actually live something out. It's not just the revealing of what's in heaven. It is your prayer on earth as it is in heaven. That prayer on earth just as it is in heaven. The just as it is in heaven is the revelation. The on earth is the wisdom. You ever heard the statement, someone is so heavenly minded that they're not any earthly good? That's only true to a person who receives revelation and then refuses to act upon it. So is it a possibility that you could be so earth or so heavenly minded that you're no earthly good? Yeah, sure, but you would have to intentionally be denying the Spirit of God in your life in order to do that. You would intentionally be listening to hear and to see who Jesus is and to look at how beautiful He is and have your mind and your revelatory side of yourself, you know, the side that gets excited about truth and the revealing of knowledge, that side gets illuminated and you get so excited about it. But then when you face it in real life, you would have to literally deny the Christ in your life in order to fulfill that statement, so heavenly minded that you're no earthly good. The invitation is that when the Lord reveals something, He's actually inviting you to experience it on earth just as you have experienced it in heaven. Are you with me this morning? So we've been talking about wisdom, and that's what this process is. It is the process of seeing, hearing, knowing what heaven is like, and then having practical, like full-on knowledge, understanding, wisdom to live it out in real time. And in my opinion, it is what the church needs most. We get so theoretical. Nothing wrong. If you're driven by theoretical thought, if you're driven by theory, you want to explore all facets of information. I'm not against that this morning. I think that is a beautiful thing. However, those theories have to turn out and actually produce something in your life. I think I'm preaching to myself this morning. Isaiah chapter 60. Isaiah 60. We started in Isaiah 60 last week. We're going to start in it again this week. Isaiah 60 reads like this. Arise and shine, for your light has come. All right. Two very clear statements there. Arise and shine. That is an action step. For your light has come. That's a revelatory statement. In other words, here's some information. Your light has come. Who is the light of the world? Jesus, right? Jesus came. He is the light of the world. Because he came, because he accomplished everything that he came to accomplish, you now have a responsibility to arise and shine. The light came, revelation, your response to revelation. You should arise and shine. But this becomes the issue that we face. We don't know how to do that. If you knew how to do that, you'd be doing it. If the church knew how to do that, if the church, the religious institution over the last several, thousand years, knew how to do this and perfected it, then we would have the results of this, which is, look, arise and shine, for the light has come. The glory of the Lord has risen upon you. Behold, there's deep darkness covering the earth, a deep darkness the people. But the Lord will rise upon you. His glory will appear upon you. Nations will come to your light. Kings to the brightness of your rising. Lift up your eyes round about and see. They all are gathering together. They come to you. Your sons will come from afar. Your daughters will be carried in arms. Then you will see and be radiant. Your heart will thrill and rejoice because the abundance of the sea will turn to you and the wealth of the nations will come to you. This is quite the prophetic promise. There's all sorts of stuff tied up in here. When I read this, my heart, I thrill at the prospect of this promise because it's been fulfilled in Christ Jesus. The light has come. There's a response that I am responsible for, that I get to arise and shine. And in my process of learning how to do that, there is some tremendous results that happen. Now, I'm a results guy. Anybody in here, results? I'm results oriented. I don't care what your theory is. The proof is in the pudding. Don't tell me your idea. Show me it works. Lots of people have ideas, but it takes something. There is a different gear where you take your idea, you flush it out, you actually prove that it works, and then you present it. Are you with me here? How many actually are like this? Thank you. I'm not alone. I'm not alone this morning. I was feeling lonely for a second, and now you help me out here. To know that something works, to see fruit of an outcome, to see when you have intentionally, when you have grabbed hold of a theory and then you've proven it out and there are these results, this gives a tremendous amount of confidence to you. It also helps other people to be able to follow you. If you only present a theory, it becomes very difficult for anybody to act upon it. I'm trying to help some of y'all out this morning because you've been theorizing about things and you've been wondering for a long time why it hasn't happened yet. Wonder no more. We, as people of God, are not just called to preach at the world. We're not just called to tell them the theory of Jesus and tell them that it transforms life. We're not just called to preach the good news and say it's really good news and then live lives that are actually filled with garbage. Now I'm going to get up in your stuff this morning. Come on, you didn't come to church to hear a nice message, did you? You came to have somebody poke you in the eye. That's why people come to church, right? John chapter 1 says that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. When the Word becomes flesh and actually dwells in your life, when He speaks something, the revelation actually gets fleshed out, that's when it says that we beheld Him, the glory of the Father, full of wisdom and truth, full of grace. We beheld Him. When people see that revelation of what heaven has been saying, what the Bible has been saying, what God's Word says, but then you take it and you actually flush it out in your life where the Word becomes flesh, that is when the people around you begin to behold the glory. Arise and shine, the light has come. Okay, revelation has come. We have seen what the Father is like. He was displayed in the person of Jesus. We know what heaven's like because we can look at Jesus. When the Word becomes flesh, that's when the world gets to see what Jesus is like. That's when the world will see the glory resting upon people. What if I told you, it's a little bit off topic, but what if I told you that literally the greatest experience, if you wanted, you know, if I gave you a promise right now, I said, hey, you will start to experience the tangible presence of God. You'll see miracles happen in your life. You will see, it will impact people around you. You will actually see a harvest come in, and all you had to do is one thing. You'd probably buy my book, right? You would want to listen to the infomercial. It would perk your interest, yeah? You know what that one thing is? That one thing is literally whatever He spoke to you last, don't move on to another point. Stay on whatever He said last and actually flush it out until it literally has become a part of your life. Don't move on. Don't try to go get more revelation. Manifest that manna. Stay on it. Abide in the Word. His Word abides in you, and then whatever you ask, it'll be done for you. Stay on the point. We become revelation savvy. We want more and more and more revelation, but then the wisdom part gets stopped up, where we're getting more and more revealed to us because we're pursuing, and God's gracious. He's going to show you things. He loves you, right? He loves you. But the goal of Him showing you stuff is not so you are smarter or that you can preach better sermons. It's so that your life will change. You want miracles in your life? Don't change the point. What did He say last to you? I mean, seriously, we could just stop here today. What's the last thing He said to you? Did you do it? Well, sure, I did it once. Did you do it again? No, I thought that was it. No. No, stay there. Don't change the point. Are you alive this morning? If you want to see the fruit of the Word of the Lord be born out of your life, the Word comes and it's sown into the soil of your heart, and it goes through a cycle. It goes through hardened ground, where you're rejected at first. Then it goes through soil that has rocks in it, wrong patterns of thought, you know, strongholds, patterns of thought in your life that it rejects the Word eventually, where it doesn't allow it actually to take root in your life because you have ideas that actually usurp what God's telling you to do. You have thoughts that go against it. Right? And then when it finally breaks through the hardened ground of your life and you finally get it going, now the process becomes about the trials of this world or the deceitfulness of wealth. Right? And it's attempting to choke out that fruit. Because once you figure it out, the American way is to try to make money off of it. Once you figured it out, now what you're going to do is you begin to see the profitability of what you just figured out. Now you figure out how to sell it, right? Well, you just got deceived by the deceitfulness of wealth, and it's choking out the fruit-bearing capacity. This is the cycle. And if you pass that test, guess what you're into? Fruitfulness, baby. But so few people want to stay the course. You got to stay the course. Don't change the point. What did he say last to you? I have one of those kinds of words to you this morning. If you don't change the point, you're going to see glory manifested in your life. You ready? There was one point in history where the kingdom of Israel manifested a weight of glory that caused the nations to stream to Israel to be influenced. There was a time in history where the nation of Israel was representing the most influential nation in the world. You know, lots of nations have held this kind of prominence throughout world history. Lots of different nations have been that kind of polarizing world. You know, in biblical times, you had Assyria, you had Babylon, you had Israel, you had Rome, right? You had Egypt. There are different points in history where there was one nation that was kind of ruling them all, if you will. Are you with me this morning? Take it into modern times, America has enjoyed that light over the last season where we have been an influential nation in the world. Well, Israel held that prominence for a season. It was under the rule of King Solomon. It was under the rule of King Solomon. When Solomon was king, the nations were streaming to Israel to be influenced by what was happening there. Why were they coming? What was Solomon known for? What was Israel at that time known for? It was known for wisdom. There was something about the rule of Solomon that he was seeing, hearing, perceiving heavenly understanding, things that people had never heard before. He understood botany. He understood the system of living things and creatures and plants, and he understood how the seasons worked, and he was teaching on these things and helping people to understand agriculture, and he was brilliant. The Lord was revealing stuff to him, but then he would flesh it out in real life. He was also a brilliant businessman. He went from Israel being, sure, a powerful nation. King David warred with everybody around him, gained territory, was a powerful presence. When Solomon came, though, he stopped going to war with people and he just started taxing them. He found a way to make money off of them instead of fighting them. And it created peace in the entire world. Solomon had such a wisdom that nations, kings, peoples would come to him to be influenced, and they were happy to pay him for it because they wanted to know the best way of living. This is something that we have in common with the rest of humanity. People want to know how to live their lives. People want healthy families. People want to know how to have prosperity in their homes. No one wants to go hungry tonight. Nobody does. Nobody wants to have strife and pain in their life. People want to live healthy. People want to have the strength and vigor of life and experience life abundantly. That's universal. That pursuit of that, that's something that's wired into people. Not just pleasure, but the life abundant. People want this. And they saw it in Solomon. He was helping them to know how to do that. What's interesting about this time in history is that Solomon was known for wisdom. He was not known for righteousness. Dude had hundreds of wives and hundreds of concubines. He was known to marry interculturally, which was a no-no in Israel. You know, no-no? My children know no-no well. In fact, they think that's a form of communication, like that's a language thing. In fact, this is some of the first words that they hear and understand and then repeat back to us, right? They go into the light switch or the outlet, right? No-no. So they just assume that that thing on the wall with the holes that they like to poke things in is a no-no. Right? And then eventually, you know, through ways of discipline, they learn that no-no actually means no, stop, right? Pain associated. No-no. See, Solomon wasn't hearing God's no-no when it came to these kinds of things. So he started building foreign temples to other gods in the nation of Israel. Do you know what, though? He still prospered and the world still kept coming. He wasn't known for holiness. He wasn't known for righteousness. What he was known for is he knew how to live life. And so the world wanted to come and be influenced by the glory that rested there. The church has spent so much time preaching on living righteously, which is a good thing. Can you agree? Okay, not denying that. But so much time in terms of talking about how you have to be holy like God is holy. But the thing is that if we preach the subject of holiness and righteousness as if it's something for you to attain to, then we're all standing on the wrong side of the cross, baby. The reason Jesus came was to settle the righteousness issue so we can move on. So if all the sermons and all the preaching is about how here's the list of things you got to do to be holy, to be righteous, to live right, because holiness and you living righteously, that's what's going to cause the glory of God to rest on the church and the nations will come to know Him because we live so holy and righteous. Or not. Or maybe that's the problem. Maybe the problem is that we've been preaching holiness and righteousness as if it's something that we still have to earn and walk in, and not assuming that it's a done deal through the person of Christ. That if you begin to rest in His holiness and in His righteousness, your life will manifest it for sure. But the problem isn't that you're not holy and not righteous. That's not the problem. He dealt with sin. Jesus paid for all the sins of the world. All of the sin of the world. Not even the ones that asked for forgiveness. All of it. Sin isn't the issue anymore. The issue is the manifestation of the ways of God. The issue is the glory that rests on a people who would manifest His wisdom. The issue is that we preach theory and righteousness and holiness, and that's not what causes the glory to rest. That's a done deal in the person of Jesus. We got to learn how to manifest that thing. We see this in the life of Solomon, and the topic today, the thing that I want to just get into, is this. In the law, 6 times in the law of Moses, an issue was discussed. 6 times. That's not very many. It's enough. It's repeated. In the prophets, in all of the prophets' writings, 16 times an issue was discussed. Now, I'm not telling you what the issue is yet. I hope you've noticed that. 6 times in the law, 16 times in the prophets. In the New Testament, this issue is discussed 40 times. So in the whole of the Old Testament, the law and the prophets, an issue is discussed 21 times. And in the, 22 times. In the New Testament, an issue is discussed 40 times. There's a precedence being set here. Something is important. And in the book of Proverbs, the issue is discussed 33 times. The issue is this, James 1:27. Pure and undefiled religion in the sight of God and our Father is this. To visit, and that word visit means to be concerned about, to show care, to demonstrate care. 2, show concern towards orphans and widows in their distress. The issue of people who are in poverty or people who don't have a voice in our society to speak up for, to take care of those who are unable to defend themselves. In the Old Testament, a widow was a woman who was married at one point, her husband has died, and in that society, you needed a male voice to represent you in business, to represent you in the family dealings. You couldn't possess property. There was lots of limitations. If you were a female in that society, if your husband died, you had to move back in with your father's household so that you could have a livelihood. You couldn't do it. If you're an orphan, that means you have no representation, right? Your parents have died. Or you never had parents, right? Or you were in where you were born out of wedlock or something, and there was something that kept you estranged. You didn't have a family name. You had no one to represent you. You had no inheritance in Israel. You didn't have. These are those who don't have a voice. Are you with me here this morning? Pure and undefiled religion. The demonstration of what Christianity is, what God is like relating to people. The demonstration of that in its pure form looks like you and I getting involved in people's lives who are unable to defend themselves. That issue is discussed 6 times in the law, 16 times in the prophets, 40 times in the New Testament, and 33 times in the book of Proverbs. In other words, Solomon saw something. When wisdom, when the revelation of who God is and then how to display it in the earth, when that hit his life, he recognized this is not a side issue. To work with people who are in poverty, to work with people who don't have a voice, that it's not a religious duty. It's actually a function of what heaven is like. It's not a spiritual function in terms of you can't set aside. You know, this is how I've approached it in the past. I don't know how you've approached it. When I think about giving to the poor or somebody who's going to go live their life in an orphanage and you know, take care. When I think of Mother Teresa, these kinds of people, I always think of them in terms of spirituality. Solomon didn't see it as a spiritual issue. He wasn't that spiritual of a guy. Or he was super ultra spiritual, but we're not talking about like in the worship of Yah, God. Solomon saw it as a political issue, as a nationalistic issue. He saw it as a societal issue, like, hey, we actually have to be working with this group of people. You can't just disenfranchise them. You have to give them a voice. He saw this as an equality issue where he would give people voice that didn't have voice. For instance, he has 2 widows come before him. Both of them had babies. Remember this story? Maybe some of you do. Some this will be new to. 2 women come. One has an alive child. The other one has a dead child. Both had babies. They were both widows. They were both living in the same house. One of the women rolled over on her baby and killed it. Took the other woman's baby and swapped it out with the dead baby and now is saying that this is her baby, and she's the one that killed her baby. Are you with me? The 2 women come before him. They have the dead baby. They have the alive baby. Solomon says, whose baby is it? They both go, it's mine. She's lying. So this is what Solomon does. He gives the widow a voice. You got to see this. Why is the king seeing 2 widows? In that day, they had no representation in the court. In that day, this is Solomon, the king. Not just the king, he was the king of kings in their day. The chief ruler of all the world is sitting down with 2 people that have no voice in society. Hello? Solomon goes, hey, give me a sword. I'll cut the baby in half and y'all can have one half each. The mother says, no, no, you can have the child because a mom would rather have the child live, right? Solomon knew that, and as soon as he saw that, he goes, ah, that's the mother. See, wisdom gives justice to those who don't have a voice. This is actually a function of government. Wisdom is a function of demonstrating who the Father is and what heaven is like, because in heaven, it is a just place. Heaven gives a voice to people that don't have a voice. I bet there are some issues, some people groups in our society right now that haven't been given voice that you see as a political issue or as a sociological issue, where's the church's involvement in that? Oh, that's a government issue. That's their problem. Nationalistic issue. Solomon didn't see the difference. He actually said, oh, no, this is what heaven's like. We're going to make sure that the voiceless have a voice. It's actually a function of wisdom. It's actually a function of glory manifesting on a people. This isn't just a spiritual issue. This is an issue that you, if you want to display the glory of heaven, you must get involved. You're getting me distracted this morning, getting me off point. Stop it. What does the Proverbs say about this? It's interesting. The Proverbs actually highlight two systemic issues that in dealing with the poor, that these are the two actual problems. See if you can figure out what it is. Proverbs 10:15. The rich man's wealth is his fortress, but the ruin of the poor is their poverty. The rich man's wealth is his fortress. He feels like nothing can alter his life. Doesn't matter what comes. He's got money, right? Doesn't matter if there's if the crops fail in one season. Doesn't really matter. He's got money. He can sustain, right? All of the little bumps in life, they're all handled. He can handle them because he's got wealth. The ruin of the poor man is his poverty. See, when something comes about in life where he didn't have the provision to cover some unexpected thing that happens, it takes them out. Look at this next one. Abundant food is in the fallow ground of the poor, but it's swept away by injustice. So in the very ground that the poor are occupying, they could grow food. They could provide for themselves. They could do it. But the problem is that it's swept away by injustice. Again, it's that picture. Right? Here's a story, right? Let's say you have a family who's living paycheck to paycheck, barely scraping by. I mean, they have multiple generations of their family working in order to provide. This is a tale that we should understand and know. This is a prevalent reality in America. Multiple generations working towards so that we can sustain as a family unit. This is what most of the world experiences. You know, we're not just talking dual income homes. We're talking everybody works to provide, to take care of the family. But when you're living paycheck to paycheck and you have nothing, let's say one of the kid is getting ahead, right? They're saving up and they're going to put one of the children through college, and they have this savings account and they're saving up for it and they're saving up for it and they're saving up for it, right? And now they have a little nest egg and they're finally going to break through the poverty line because they can put someone through college, and then their family is going to go to a different place in society. You with me here? And so the family's working for it, and everybody's, and then dad's going to work one day. He's driving through an intersection, and boom! A car blindsides him through the intersection. The car is ruined, and dad ends up in a hospital stay for a week. All the savings gone. They no longer have a car. No one even can get to work anymore. See, the provision was there in their labor. They could do it if everything could just keep going right, eventually they're going to make it. But then injustice sweeps in. And see, the ruin of the poor, this is one of the systemic issues, is that they don't have power to change their circumstance. For whatever reason, you can't just pull your bootstraps up. There's either a spiritual resistance, there's a natural resistance. Something is preventing them. Are you with me here? No power to change the circumstance. The second one, here it is. Proverbs 14:20. The poor is hated even by his neighbor, but those who love the rich are many. Why are poor people hated by their neighbors? In Israeli society, right, in this day and age, if your neighbor came over, you had to entertain him. If a visitor comes, you give them bread. This is the societal norm. You take care of people who come to visit. Now, if your neighbor's poor, what's that neighbor doing? He's having dinner at your house every night. eventually you begin to resent the people that you are paying for their life to go forward. Eventually you begin to resent people that are imposing continuously. Right? Wealth adds many friends, but the poor man is separated from his friends. Same reason. Proverbs 19, 1 through 7. Better is a poor man, and you got to listen to the whole thing because there's a context to this. Better is a poor man who walks in his integrity, tells the truth, lives by truth, than he who is perverse in speech and is a fool, someone who lies, someone who stretches the truth. Also, it's not good for a person to be without knowledge. He who hurries his footsteps errs. The foolishness of a man ruins his own way, but his heart rages against the Lord. So you have this person, right, who through their own mouth has ruined their own way. They made choices that were foolish. It got them in trouble with people. It got them in trouble with a business dealing. It got them in trouble. And they're blaming everyone else. They're even blaming God. It's not my fault, it's his fault. It's not my fault, it's your fault. They're blaming everyone. And so you find this situation where they're powerless to do anything, and they are ruining their support system because every decision they're making isn't in knowledge. They're not actually slowing down enough to make a good decision because they're living paycheck to paycheck. They're trying to get ahead. And so you rush in your steps. You make decisions because I don't have a way to make this happen. And so I heard somebody has this business deal over here, right? And it's going to make a lot of money fast. And so I'm going to invest in that, right? And then the foolishness of their way, they invest everything they have in some Ponzi scheme, and it doesn't make money. And now they're blaming everybody else and blaming God. Lord, why did you let this happen to me? Am I telling a true story or not? Their heart rages against the Lord. Wealth adds many friends, but a poor man is separated from his friend. The false witness will not go unpunished. He who tells lies will not escape. Many will seek the favor of a generous man, and every man is a friend to him who gives gifts, but all the brothers of the poor man hate him. How much more do his friends abandon him? He pursues them with words, but they're gone. That word hatred, it literally is to despise. It is this process, and you're going to recognize it in our society, and you're going to recognize it in yourself, because you'll have experienced this at some point, or you'll have had a conversation with somebody at some point who has talked like this, right? There is a group of people in our society that are being continuously taken care of through welfare, right? The conversation around that piece, if you're for or against, or it doesn't, all these things. The conversation around it will be that you begin to resent people who are living off of your sweat and unable and unwilling to work for themselves. There's a resentment that begins to grow when someone begins to demand you to provide for their life. But if you take a step back and you look at the situation, what you'll find is, and you see the people as people and not as someone who's just taking advantage of the system or they're just trying to get one over on us or whatever, if you stop thinking like that, and just right now, stop thinking like that. King Solomon, who is the wisest man ever to live, the Bible says, this man experienced a realm of wisdom that no one else had. No one else would in the future. The man who's experienced that much heavenly revelation did not see the poor as a problem. It did not see welfare as an issue. Do you know what concubines are? I'm going to mess you up this morning. Do you know what a concubine is? You ever look at Solomon and go, man, is this guy a pervert or what? He's got 400 wives and 700 concubines. Are you kidding me? To become a concubine, it requires you to sleep with him. To become a wife, it requires you to sleep with him. Hundreds and 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 hundreds of wives and concubines. Is this guy a pervert or not? You ever judged him like that? What if you stopped seeing like that and you started seeing it through this lens? A concubine was a woman who did not have a husband or a father, someone to represent them. And if Solomon took them on as a concubine, his household would take care of them. It was welfare. It was welfare. He took on so many wives, so many concubines, in my opinion, not because he was a pervert, but because he actually held the wisdom of heaven. You can figure that one out yourself. He was creating a society, and he was doing what he could in his power to take care of people. That's what the wisdom of heaven did. It was the expression in his day. What's the expression in ours? Maybe welfare is, man, I'm just kicking it in the teeth this morning, aren't I? Maybe it's a system that's gone off its rails, or maybe it's one of the systems that's actually keeping the favor of God on our country. Because we take care of the poor. Feel free to throw your various political bumper stickers on my car on the way out today. I'll wear them with pride. There's four responses that happen in people when we start talking about this issue. The first one is we ignore it. But this is what the Proverbs say about ignoring the problem. Proverbs 21:13, he who shuts his ears to the cry of the poor will also cry himself and not be answered. He who shuts his ears to the cry of the poor, if you ignore it, will eventually cry himself and not be answered. Not a great plan. Second way that we deal with it is we blame people for it. We blame them. We put the blame on them. This is your fault. You're the one that made the bad decision. You're in it. You live with it. We blame. We ignore them or we blame them. Proverbs 17:5. He who mocks the poor taunts his maker. He who rejoices at calamity will not go unpunished. Again, not a great plan to, with your words, blame them, to, with your words, mock the situation. Oh, you're just somebody who's just sucking it dry on the system, aren't you? You know, whatever your political point is, you might want to, as a believer in Jesus Christ, and as a representative of the King of Kings and God the Father, who his intention and the wisdom of that he governs his world with, make sure that everyone has a voice and everyone is fairly represented and everyone's taken care of. It's probably not a good idea to be mocking the very group of people he defends. So we ignore them, we blame them. The third way, we take advantage of them. He who oppresses the poor to make more for himself or will only come to poverty. He who oppresses the poor to make more for himself or gives to the rich will only come to poverty. Proverbs 22:22. Do not rob the poor because he's poor or crush the afflicted at the gate, for the Lord will plead their case and take the life of those who rob them. So we ignore them, we blame them, we take advantage of them, or the fourth option is we help. We help. We help. Now, in our moment of history, I think this is where maybe the train has gone off the tracks a little bit. Maybe we need to readjust how we think about it, how we work through the issue, how we need to. A welfare system where that kind of process, it hasn't necessarily produced the fruit that we're wanting it to. It, you know, call it what it is. We gotta work some stuff out here. we're not doing a great job at taking care of all the poor. When there's people in America, the most abundant nation in the world, going hungry, there's an issue. When, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that plays into this. I'm not going to attempt to be an economist this morning or any of these things. I'm just talking about it straight out from a wisdom point of view. We are supposed to get involved in some way. Now, the reason I pointed out, what are the two issues? The first issue is they don't have power to change the situation themselves. And the second issue is they don't have a support system. So when something goes wrong, they don't have anybody to help. No power to change things and no one to help. Do you know what answers both of those issues? Because this isn't a money issue. Giving someone power, saying to them, I believe in you, you can do it, that doesn't require money. Coming alongside someone and coaching them to a victory doesn't take money. It takes you. It doesn't take money, though. It's not a handout. It's you cheering someone on until they actually accomplish. It's you giving your power to them. A support system where the church, the people of God, we should not distance ourselves from people who are in need. We can be a support system without enabling the problem. Both of these things are answered in family. Both of them, both issues are answered in the context of family. And if the body of Christ is a family, which we are, then we have the ability just in this group of people to change the lives of so many. And it's not because you're going to give them a handout. But we got to figure some stuff out here, y'all. I had like two amens on that one. I know you're thinking, I know you're processing this morning. I'm not going to hit you for an offering after this, please. You can unguard your wallet or whatever you're having to do right now. Because we're not building a welfare system. We're not going to do that again. It didn't work the first time. No, we're doing something at least, but wait, we got to figure this out. I'm hoping that somebody here has got a better solution. I'm hoping that the wisdom of God would touch somebody's heart who's willing, and the Lord would bring something to mind that it would actually bring about a fruit. We help. So we either ignore them, we blame them, we take advantage of them, we help. You know, when you look at the life of Christ, it's really interesting because Jesus himself defined his ministry through this lens. Listen to this. This is Matthew 11, verse 2, and the ones following. John the Baptist is in prison, and John sends some of his disciples over to Jesus to find out if he's the Messiah. And this is Jesus' response. When John, while imprisoned, heard of all the works that Jesus was doing, he sent word by his disciples to him and said, "Are you the expected one, or should we look for someone else?" Jesus answered and said to them, "Go report this to John. What you hear and what you see, the blind receive sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, all signs and wonders. And the poor have the gospel preached to them." He defined his ministry as with this function. I am intentionally ministering, giving life, power, instruction, helping those who have been disenfranchised and cannot help themselves. I'm going after them. Demonstration of the kingdom. It's not just a spiritual thing. It's an actual tangible thing for us to demonstrate the king. As a church, we have amazing opportunity. We, you know, you are in relationship with people who need, you're in relationship with people who, you know, have experienced pain, find themselves in situations where they can't They can't pull themselves up by the bootstraps. You are in relationship with all these folks. The answer isn't, can I just tell you what the answer isn't? The answer isn't, let's build the church as a nonprofit organization that builds another welfare system and takes care of all their needs. That's not the answer. Now, I would love for 100, 1,000 more organizations that are doing something. Go for it. If that's you, go for it. But as a church, the answer isn't we once a month we take up a benevolence offering, and then we're the ones that control how that money is delegated. That's not the answer. It didn't work before. It's not going to work. The answer lies in the people, in each of us as individuals, actually walking in relationship with people. Because what gets people out of the spirit of poverty is family. It's power and it's help and aid in their time of need, someone to support, to walk them through it. It's going to require us, you, me, individually. Now, you can ignore it. You know, you pull up to the stoplight, there's someone standing on the corner. Don't tell me you haven't done this before. I know you've done this, right? You look over, make sure your doors are locked. Right? As you pull up, you pull up right next to them. And then, your eyes. This is very important. If you make eye contact, you're in trouble. If you make eye contact, you're in trouble. See, what you have to do is you have to look down. You have to pick up your phone, right? Or you need to look the other way. Pretend like you're checking your hair out. Do something, right, that's in this general direction, away from the person. And if you do that successfully, then you can ignore them. Or a better option is when you pull up to that light and you see someone standing there with a sign, is to judge them and blame them for the situation they're in. Man, I don't even know what they got. Obviously have time. Go get a job, man. Go get a job. You're just gonna spend that money on drugs or alcohol. You're gonna waste it anyway. I'm working hard for this. And clearly, you're not. This is your fault. Right, so I don't need to not make eye contact. I can make eye contact with you because I'm judging you and I hate you. And I'll tell you with my eyes, and don't even think for a moment that you're the first one today to do that to them. Because all day long they've been looking at people that have been judging them. All day long they've been experiencing this. You're not the new one on the block. Right? You're not the first one to own that thing. Blaming people. So you can ignore them, you can blame them. You can take advantage of them. Right? You can take advantage of them. You can try to make money off their situation. Hey, I know what we'll do. We'll start a nonprofit organization to take care of these folks. We'll take donations in from all over the world. And what we're actually going to do is we're going to pad the salary of everybody who works here. And all the money that comes in, it isn't going to matter because a very small percentage of it's even going to go there. There's an interesting list that comes out every Christmas, judging all the nonprofit organizations, how much of your money goes there. You know, the Goodwill, these kinds of places. Goodwill, Salvation Army, all that. You ought to look to see how much that money goes out. Some of the things you think you're donating to are people that are helping. No, they're not. No, they're not. It's just a thrift store. They're making money. So while your conscience goes clean because you dropped off a load of crap, they made money on your crap and nobody benefited. Am I shooting straight or what today, huh? My wife is rolling her eyes and covering. She's refusing to make eye contact. Come on. We got to get real here. We got to get real. I wish I could say, yes, the answer is just... Look, in the New Testament, in the days of the apostles, you know what the answer was? They didn't have nonprofit organizations. They didn't have people who were in that place to be able to steward it like we have today. In that day, the only answer was the church. So people would sell tracts of land, and they'd go and lay all the money at the apostles' feet, and the apostles would hand it over to the deacons, and the deacons were just tending tables. giving it out to the poor. This is what they did, and this was one of the functions of the early gatherings. You know, we have those kinds of functions in different organizations. It's not necessarily the sole function of the church organization. In fact, when Jesus talks about gatherings, when you come together, what he says is the most important thing for you and I to do. This is out of Luke chapter 14, verses 12 through 14. Listen to this. He was staying in one of the homes, right, that invited him, and he began to spoke to the homeowner, and he said, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or brothers or relatives or rich neighbors. Otherwise, they may also invite you in return, and then you'll have a repayment. But when you give a reception, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and then you will be blessed. That word blessed is you'll be just like God. Since they do not have means to repay you, then you will be repaid in the resurrection. When Jesus points to gatherings like this, he goes, hey, don't just try to gather people with money. Don't just try to gather the people that are comfortable. Intentionally reach out to those who are disenfranchised. Don't just make this about suburbia. Make this about actually reaching out and making sure people are welcome. If you came in this morning, right, and you bumped into two or three homeless people that happened to be attending church here on the morning, right, would you pull your kid closer and walk away? Would you... You know, if you're an usher here today, would something in you be like, oh, I don't, you know, this is where Pastor Jamie's family sits. I don't think it's the best idea for you to be sitting here. We're going to go ahead and move you to a different seat. This is where the elders sit, over here. What's the reaction in your heart? Look at James. Pure undefiled religion is this in the sight of God, to visit orphans and widows in their time of distress, to keep one unstained from the world. My brethren, do not hold your faith in this glorious Lord and Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism. For if a man comes into your assembly with a gold ring dressed in fine clothes, and there comes also a poor man in dirty clothes, and you pay special attention to the one wearing fine clothes and say, you sit here in a good place, and you say to the poor man, stand over there or sit at my footstool, have you made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil motives? Listen, my brethren, did not God choose the poor of this world to be rich in faith and the heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who would love him? But you have dishonored the poor man. Is it not the rich who are oppressing you and personally dragging you into court? Do they not blaspheme in fair name by which you have been called? If, however, you're fulfilling the royal law according to the scripture that you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing well. But if you show partiality, you're committing sin and are convicted by that law. In an assembly like this, do you know what our chief responsibility is? It's not to give money away. Chief responsibility is make sure everyone has a voice, they feel powerful, we're tending to people, we're loving people no matter the social status. Everybody gets to be a part of the family. I got one more scripture. Can you do it? Last night I warned him. I said, hey, I'm about to open up a fire hose. I apologize for it ahead of time. I'll apologize for this on the after side of it. I know this has been like nonstop. Some of your hair is just like greased back. Ears are pinned back. We started with Isaiah 60. Arise and shine. Your light has come. Right? Arise and shine. The glory of the Lord is going to show on you. The light that's going to shine off you is going to come because you arise, because you stand up, because you do something. We've already discovered that rising, that is the demonstration of wisdom. You're in righteousness because of Christ. It's not how holy you are. That's not why the glory rests on you. It's because you demonstrate heaven. Listen to this last passage. You ready? Isaiah 58, verses 5 through 8. Is it a fast like this which I choose this day? For a man to humble himself? Is it for bowing one's head like a reed? For spreading out sackcloth and ashes as a bed? Will you call this a fast? Even an acceptable day of the Lord? Is this not the fast that I will choose? To loosen the bonds of wickedness? to undo the bands of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and break every yoke? Is it not to divide your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover him. Don't hide yourself from your own flesh. Then, everyone say then. Okay, two different opinions. The first one is, hey, we're going to have a spiritual fast. You're going to fast so you can get more revelation. You can be in connection with God. You're going to be all pious, right? And set apart as holy. Because after all, isn't this the point of fasting? Isn't that the point of fact? I'm trying to become more like Jesus. So I fast for 40 days and I put on my gauntest face. And I'm depressed. I'm walking around in ashes. Woe is me. I'm fasting to be like Jesus. Is that the fast that God desires? Or is this the fast that you break bread with the poor? That when you see someone who's stuck, you unstuck them? When you recognize that something is actually holding someone back, you make it your priority to step in and to help them get free from whatever that is. If someone is naked, you give them clothes. Then, if you do that kind of fast, then your light will break out like the dawn, your recovery will be speedily, your righteousness will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will become your rear guard. Arise and shine, your light has come, the glory of the Lord is going to rest on you when you arise. That glory is manifested in a people who choose to embrace the ways of wisdom. And one of the ways that wisdom demonstrates us, one of the ways that the kingdom demonstrates itself, is not by the self-sacrifice of choosing to be pious and just, I'm just being spiritual and that's why I'm taking care of you, or that's why. It is in the demonstration of creating ways to make people powerful again and draw them into community to intentionally engage their distress and help. To help. Pastor Jamie, how do I do that? You know what? I don't care how you do it. I care that you do it. Sit down with your family this afternoon over your nice lunch and discuss how at least once a month you're going to do something. Share with your children how this is a priority. Talk about it. Get it out in the open. Be ultra practical. Don't just do nothing. Do something. I will end with a Heidi Baker quote. Would you stand to your feet today? Heidi Baker famously has said, or least famous in our circles, has said concerning her own ministry to the poor and taking care of those who can't take care of themselves. She says, when you see somebody that's in this place of brokenness, love looks like something. You can't look at a one-legged cripple who's begging and then not do something. Love looks like something. And I don't care what the something is, it looks like something. It looks like having a conversation and giving them power. It looks like ministry, absolutely, but we're talking, come on. This is practical. We got to do something. Are you with me this morning? The glory of the Lord rests on a people who choose this. So Father, this morning as a people, we come before you. Lord, is there revelation here? Clarity. This is what the kingdom's like. You betcha. Now, Father, I'm asking this morning that you would give us opportunity to demonstrate. Holy Spirit, that you would fill our hearts, our minds, that our minds would be renewed this morning to no longer see this as a spiritual problem, but this is actually a real-time problem that we have opportunity to do something about. And it manifests your kingdom when we do so. Lord, I thank you for this people. This is a powerful people. God, there's so much good that you can do in and through this church. And Lord, I thank you for it. Lord, I just bless them this morning. I pray, Holy Spirit, that you would bring a conviction. Absolutely, bring a conviction concerning these things. But then, Lord, send your angels out before us to set up the good works that we could walk in. Lord, I thank you for this opportunity. I bless your people this morning.